have or do not need. Best practice. Tailor training to the individual's needs. 3. Deliver assessments with care. Feedback on a person's strengths and weaknesses carries an emotional charge. Caveat. Inept feedback can be upsetting. Skillful feedback is motivating. Best practice. Use emotional intelligence in delivering initial evaluations of a person's emotional competence. 4. Gauge readiness. People are at differing levels of readiness. Caveat. When people lack readiness, training is more likely to be wasted. Best practice. Assess for readiness, and if someone is not yet ready, make cultivating readiness an initial focus. 5. Motivate. People learn to the degree they are motivated. For example, by realizing that a competence is important to doing their job well, and making the competence a personal goal for change. Caveat. If people are unmotivated, training will lack effectiveness. Best practice. Make clear how training will pay off on the job or for the individual's career or be otherwise rewarding. 6. Make change self-directed. When people direct their learning program, tailoring it to their needs, circumstances, and motivation, learning is more effective. Caveat. One-size-fits-all training programs fit no one specifically. Best practice. Have people choose their own goals for development and help them design their own plan for pursuing them. 7. Focus on clear, manageable goals. People need clarity on what the competence is and the steps needed to improve it. Caveat. Poorly focused or unrealistic programs for change lead to fuzzy results or failure. Best practice. Spell out the specifics of the competence and offer a workable plan to get there. 8. Prevent relapse. Habits change slowly, and relapses and slips need not signal defeat. Caveat. People can become discouraged by the slowness of change and the inertia of old habits. Best practice. Help people use lapses and slip-ups as lessons to prepare themselves better for the next time. 9. Give performance feedback. Ongoing feedback encourages and helps direct change. Caveat. Fuzzy feedback can send the training off track. Best practice. Design into the change plan feedback from supervisors, peers, friends, anyone who can help coach, mentor, or give appropriate progress reviews. 10. Encourage practice. Lasting change requires sustained practice both on and off the job. Caveat. A single seminar or workshop is a beginning, but not sufficient in itself. Best practice. Use naturally arising opportunities for practice at work and at home, and try the new behaviors repeatedly and consistently over a period of months. 11. Arrange support. Like-minded people who are also trying to make similar changes can offer crucial ongoing support. Caveat. Going it alone makes change tougher. Best practice. Build a network of support and encouragement. Even a single buddy or coach will help. 12. Provide models. High-status, highly effective people who embody the competence can be models who inspire change. Caveat. A do-what-I-say, not-what-I-do attitude in superiors undermines change. Best practice. Encourage supervisors to value and exhibit the competence. Make sure trainers do, too. 13. Encourage. Change will be greater if the organization's environment supports the change, values the competence, and offers a safe atmosphere for experimentation. Caveat. When there is no real support, particularly from bosses, the change effort will seem hollow or too risky. Best practice. Encourage change that fits the values of the organization. Show that the competence matters for job placement, promotion, performance review, and the like. 14. Reinforce change. People need recognition to feel their change efforts matter. Caveat. A lack of reinforcement is discouraging. Best practice. Be sure the organization shows it values the change in a consequential way. Praise, a raise, or expanded responsibility. 15. Evaluate. Establish ways to evaluate the development effort to see if it has lasting effects. Caveat. Many or most development programs go unevaluated, and so mistakes or pointless programs go unchanged. Best practice. Find measures of the competence or skill as shown on the job, ideally before and after training, and also several months, and if possible, a year or two later. Teaching the skills that matter. She was an accountant in the healthcare industry, and she had a real problem. She couldn't take criticism. When she felt her ideas or her character were being attacked, her anger flared, and she said things she felt ashamed about later. But she was determined to do something about it. Now enrolled in an executive MBA program, she had an opportunity to cultivate emotional self-control, a competence she knew she needed to improve. Her plan for doing so was multi-pronged. Learn and master steps for better control, such as anticipating hot-button situations and preparing herself so that she wouldn't lose it. Remind herself that what she sees as criticism or an attack is most often feedback that is meant to be helpful. Practice those responses at every opportunity. Mentally rehearse them twice a month. Recruit fellow students to role-play troubling situations with her so she can try out new self-control strategies. Have a fellow member of her learning team agree to signal her when she sees her being stubborn, inflexible, or otherwise overreacting to remind her to exercise self-control. This set of learning tactics, so well suited to cultivating emotional intelligence, may seem out of place in an MBA program, but they are part of the curriculum at the Weatherhead School of Management at Case Western Reserve University in Cleveland, a leader in preparing its students in these crucial capabilities. Weatherhead took to heart a number of common criticisms of MBA graduates, including that they are too analytical and lack interpersonal communication and team skills. So the school embarked on a plan to reinvent business education, developing an innovative course, Managerial Assessment and Development, that incorporates many, if not most, of the consortium guidelines. The course, spearheaded by Richard Boyatzis, an associate dean, offers students tools for lifelong learning, methods for assessing and developing the personal abilities they need for management throughout their career. Since 1990, it has been offered to several different groups of students. Most are men and women in their 20s and 30s who have decided to go back to business school for an MBA after several years on the job. It is also offered to physicians, lawyers, and other professionals, most of them in their 40s and 50s, who attend a special one-year non-degree program at Weatherhead. The course begins with a period of self-examination, during which students reflect on their values, aspirations, and goals. They then go through a range of assessments of their competencies, identifying their strengths and weaknesses. The course provides a map of the emotional competencies similar to those outlined in Chapter 2. From this map, and in light of their own assessment results and their career needs, each student chooses a set of competencies to strengthen. Instead of the one-size-fits-all approach so familiar in organizational training, students construct an individualized learning plan for themselves. The class meets for 1 3-hour session a week. The first 2 weeks focus on assessment. The next 7 weeks reflect on the results. Only then, when the assessments and their implications have been fully digested, do students spend up to 5 weeks developing their learning plans, like that of the hot-tempered financial advisor who needed to cultivate self-control. Does it work? To find out, successive graduating classes of Weatherhead students have been put through a set of rigorous assessments using objective measures common in industry. Compared to similar ratings on entering the school, they showed improvement in 86% of the abilities assessed, and follow-ups 3 years after they had finished the program showed these gains holding on the job. The moral for business education. Students can master the emotional intelligence capabilities the working world demands if they are given the right tools for learning. Getting back to work. One of the more innovative workplace applications of emotional intelligence training is not to be found in any company. It's a program for people who have lost their jobs, and it's designed to help them cultivate the inner resources that will help them find a new one. Because people are shaken after losing a job, uncertain about their future, frightened about finances, and haunted by self-doubt, the job search itself can be made easier by boosting their emotional confidence. That was the strategy used in a strikingly successful re-employment project, the Michigan Jobs Program, set up by a group at the University of Michigan after a wave of job cuts in the state's auto industry. The program was a huge success, and another model application of the consortium guidelines. People who went through the program got jobs about 20% more quickly and higher quality jobs than did comparable people who had not. This works for everyone, the laid-off vice president, as well as the guy who used to empty the VP's ashtrays, says Robert Kaplan, head of the Organizational Behavior Program at George Washington University and co-founder of the Jobs Program with Richard Price, a psychologist at the University of Michigan. The underlying principle is simple. Many of the same emotional competencies that make people excel at work also make them more adept at finding a new job. Helping people boost those competencies helps them get back to work sooner and do better once they're there. If you're shy, as well as pessimistic and depressed after losing your job, you're at double jeopardy, Kaplan says. It's a paralyzing combination. Yet, the Jobs Program found that job seekers who faced the worst odds in finding new employment benefited the most from the training. This works even for those who are clinically depressed, as many people are after they've lost their job, Kaplan found. Jobs instills two sets of abilities in job seekers. Practical skills, like identifying marketable talents and networking to hear about opportunities, and the inner resiliencies that let them capitalize on their marketability. In the simple five-session format, two trainers work with groups of 15 to 20 participants, most recruited through corporate outplacement programs. The sessions focus on action learning, employing tools like mental rehearsals, dramatizations, and role-playing of key skills. One of these skills is optimism. Given the uncertainties and setbacks that job seekers confront, they need an inoculation against defeatism in the face of failure. Rejections are an inevitable part of any job search. Discouragement can bleed into hopelessness and despair. And despair is not a marketable attitude. Small wonder depression, drinking problems, and marital strife escalate among those who remain out of work, and abate once the person finds a rewarding job. In the program, people are taught to anticipate rejection and rehearse what they should tell themselves when it happens. Anticipating such difficult moments and having a workable internal response lessens the emotional toll and speeds up the bounce-back time. Among other capabilities the program bolstered, perspective-taking, to help job seekers think like an employer. Self-confidence, the crucial sense that one can succeed, which is critical to making the effort in the first place. Networking, since most jobs are found through personal contacts. Decision-making for career management. The first offer that comes is not necessarily the one to take, and any job needs to be measured against a person's values and career goals. Emotional self-control, so that distressing feelings don't overwhelm and paralyze the person, making it difficult to put in the hard effort that is needed. All these emotional intelligence capabilities, of course, are likely to pay off after landing a job as well. That's what happened with Jobs. Midway into their second year of working, Jobs grads out-earned similar job seekers who did not go through the program by $6,420 and had estimated lifetime earnings that were $48,000 greater. The Jobs program, like those at Weatherhead and American Express, offers a model of how to help people strengthen emotional competence. Chapter 11, Best Practices. Since the 1995 publication of my book, Emotional Intelligence, programs bearing the same title have taken their place in the lineup of trendy trainings. I regularly get reports from various parts of the world that someone or other is offering a program in what purports to be emotional intelligence, often only a repackaging or slight remodeling of a program they had offered before under another name. If such programs follow the guidelines outlined here, well and good. If not, let the buyer beware. All too often, development programs for emotional intelligence are poorly designed, executed, and evaluated, and so have disappointingly little impact on people's effectiveness back on the job. Thus, the need for the guidelines elaborated on in this chapter. Though almost every program includes at least a few of these best practices, optimal impact comes from their added potency when used in combination. It will be tempting for those involved in training and development to read through the guidelines with a mental checklist in mind, ticking off those they already follow. More helpful and challenging, however, is to highlight those that are not part of the routine at one's own organization and to consider including them. Few, if any, training programs follow every one of these guidelines, but to the degree a program follows many or most, it should be discernibly more effective in producing on-the-job performance improvements. The goal: to use this new understanding of best practices to put the entire enterprise of improving soft skills on a sounder, more scientific footing. These guidelines offer a state-of-the-art blueprint for teaching and learning emotional intelligence. Assess the job. One basic question needs to be asked and answered before any training is undertaken. What does it take to do this job superbly? The answers to that question are not always readily apparent. Take strategic planners. The going theory holds that the sharper the intellect of a strategic planner, the better the performance. Planning, after all, is a purely cognitive task, or so the thinking goes. And when experts, strategic planners themselves, or those executives they report to, were polled, they pretty much agree that the single key for successful planning is analytic and conceptual thinking. True, a strategic planner can't do the job without the requisite cognitive skills, but it turns out there's more to success as a planner than brain power. Emotional skills are essential as well. Studies reveal that the outstanding strategic planners are not necessarily superior in their analytic skills. Instead, the skills that raise them above the crowd are those of emotional competence, astute political awareness, the ability to make arguments with emotional impact, and high levels of interpersonal influence. The experts had overlooked a simple fact of organizational life. Everything is political. A more objective analysis revealed that planners' effectiveness depended on knowing how to involve key decision makers in the planning process at every step, making sure these people bought into the plan's assumptions and goals and are therefore willing to adopt it. No matter how brilliant a strategic plan is, without allies and supporters, it is doomed, given the politics of organizational life. And even the smartest strategic planners can be blind to the true role of emotional competence in their success. When Coopers and Lybrand, one of the Big Six accounting and consulting firms, decided to offer their partners training in the key skills for their role, they did not assume they knew what the training should focus on. Ever methodical, in the style of their firm, they wanted data. Our charge was to identify the competencies required for success in our firm, says Margaret Eccles, the senior manager in charge of competency development at the time, who directed the initiative at Coopers and Lybrand. So we started by creating a competency model for partners. Their team started out by having partners nominate those among them who were outstanding in their performance. Once that pool of standouts was identified, they and a comparison group of average performers were studied in depth, using structured interviews in which, for instance, they were asked to describe in detail critical incidents, occasions when they had done superbly, and some where their performance had been disappointing. Transcripts of those interviews were then coded and analyzed to detect common themes and the patterns of thinking, feeling, and acting that were at the heart of their success. From those results, the list of competencies that mattered most were identified. Then these competencies were tested to see if they actually distinguished average from star performers, to be sure they held up. In short, Coopers and Lybrand followed a state-of-the-art methodology for developing a competence model. Such a systematic, objective method is needed to get a true picture of the competencies that matter most for a given role. That's why assessing the competencies that make someone outstanding at a particular job has become something of a mini-industry, with practitioners using a range of well-validated methods to tease out the ingredients of star performance. Training strategies also need to take into account the ways one set of capabilities supports another. People rarely need to improve just one competence. Emotional capabilities are interwoven, not independent. And, as we have seen, many higher-order competencies, like change catalyst or leadership, are actually constructed from others. There are some elements of emotional intelligence that are so basic as to constitute meta-abilities, which are essential for most other competencies. These basics include self-awareness, self-regulation, motivation, empathy, and social skills. These primary capabilities are essential for supporting the emotional competencies that flow from them. For instance, a manager who tries to shift his or her leadership style may also need to improve in self-awareness in order to make the other change. In studies of a European airline, what set apart superior flight attendants were two clusters of emotional intelligence attributes: a self-mastery cluster, including emotional self-control, achievement, and adaptability, and an interpersonal cluster, including influence, service, and teamwork. So when an American airline asked me and my colleague, Therese Jacob Stewart, to help design a training program for them, we focused on self-management and on handling people well. But we added two supporting emotional intelligence capabilities, each of which makes people better at those needed competencies. One is self-awareness, which helps people recognize when they are about to become victims of an amygdala hijack, and so be better able to short-circuit the hijack before they find themselves out of control. The other is empathy, which allows them to do the same for someone else, pick up the early warning signs of irritation, frustration, or anxiety that mark a person as being at risk for a hijack. The reason is simple. The best strategy for avoiding destructive encounters is to prevent them. The flight attendants also needed empathy training with an international twist. Every culture puts a unique stamp on how people express emotions. The less familiar we are with a given group, the more likely we are to misinterpret their feelings. So we focused on developing empathy with a diverse range of people. Assess the individual. Are we the best judge of our own strengths and weaknesses? Not always. Consider an irony about empathy. When you ask people how accurate they are at reading other people's feelings, there is no correlation between their answers and how well they actually perform on objective tests. In contrast, when people who know them well rate someone on empathy, there is a very high level of accuracy. In short, there are many ways in which other people know us better than we know ourselves, particularly when it comes to how adept we are in our relationships. In general, the ideal evaluation relies not on any one source, but on multiple perspectives. These may include self-reports, as well as peer, boss, and subordinate feedback. The 360-degree evaluation method offers feedback from all these sources and can be a powerful source of data targeting the competencies that need to be improved. There are several 360-degree methodologies that assess at least some of the emotional competencies. Ideally, an evaluation would also include more objective indices of work performance, such as the assessment center methods, which gauge how people do in simulations of work situations. While any method individually is fallible, used in combination, they can paint a more accurate, if complex, picture of our profile of emotional competence. See Appendix 5 for more on evaluation methods. As Susan Ennis, head of executive development at Bank Boston, observes, multiple perspectives on yourself are extremely powerful ways to build self-awareness and get you ready to do something about it. At the Weatherhead School of Management, for instance, students get information on themselves from three very different sources. First, they do a self-evaluation of their strengths and limits, as well as their values. Then there is feedback from others, including members of a working team they belong to as part of the course. peers and a boss at work, and family and friends. Finally, they get results from a battery of assessment tests and simulation exercises. They are forewarned, however, that none of these sources is in itself better or more accurate than any of the others, or less prone to distortion. Each simply adds different kinds of data and perspectives, offering a different eye, ear, and voice. The students themselves, with guidance, interpret the data, and from this, find a path to self-development. The jobs program borrowed a method from the entertainment industry to assess the emotional competence of people they were screening to hire as trainers. They held auditions. We wanted to observe them in a situation that would draw on all the social and emotional competencies they'd need as trainers, Robert Kaplan tells me. So we asked each one to come and teach us something, how to budget our money, how to interview, anything, for just 15 minutes. You could see how competent people were from the very first few moments. The auditions were telling, Kaplan recalls. One prospect would start in a business-like way, passing out budget forms and putting up a slide, starting out by saying, I want you to put how much you spent in column A. No engagement, nothing personal. Deadly. But one we hired started out in a very genuine tone. It's really good to see you here. I know what a difficult time this has been for you. I'd like to hear about each of you before I begin. You immediately felt the empathy that you liked and trusted this person. Deliver assessments with care. A health plan in the Southwest decided to evaluate employees using the 360-degree method and then have them coached as needed by their supervisors. The trouble began when someone decided to simply send all the results to both the employees and their supervisors at the same time, with no warning or interpretation. The result was a disaster. Some supervisors called employees in at once, before the employees had a chance to digest the evaluations, so many felt they were being called on the carpet rather than being helped. Some employees were enraged, especially when the supervisors' ratings were lower than those by peers, and when storming in to demand an explanation or even an apology. Feedback is too often given ineptly, with predictably bad consequences. But used artfully, feedback on competencies can be a priceless tool for self-examination and for cultivating change and growth. Used poorly, it can be an emotional bludgeon. I don't hear good things from people about their experiences with 360-degree feedback, a manager at one company tells me. The people giving the feedback lack empathy, self-awareness, and sensitivity themselves, so the experience can be brutal for those getting it. Much better is the report from a computer software giant, where an executive development specialist tells me that he delivers 360-degree feedback results strictly in confidence, one-on-one. No one else sees their results, and they never have to share them with anyone. I don't even keep a copy when I'm done with them. We want this to be a development tool, not a hammer for someone else to use. A common mistake is simply devoting too little time to the feedback. People will spend 2 or 3 days in an assessment center, going through complex simulations, taking inventory after inventory, getting all kinds of performance measures done on them, a consultant tells me. Then, after it's all done, they'll spend an hour or two going over the results in what amounts to a data dump. People end up confused, not more self-aware. If there ever was a task that called for emotional intelligence, giving people the results of 360-degree evaluations is it. Empathy, sensitivity, and delicacy are essential. One common mistake is focusing on people's weaknesses and failing to note their strong points. This can be demoralizing rather than motivating. You've got to celebrate the strengths a person has, as well as show them where their limits are, Boyatza says. Too often the focus is on someone's deficiencies, but you want to help the person recognize the core of their strengths to affirm what they value about themselves. For instance, people can gain much resolve from the belief that they have the capacity to change. At Weatherhead, great care is taken to help students interpret the results of their competence evaluations and use the information to shape a genuinely helpful learning plan. The program for executive MBAs devotes 4 3-hour sessions, plus individual counseling, to interpreting and absorbing the data from the competence evaluations. Then, four more three-hour sessions focus on using the information to create individual learning plans. Gauge readiness. A large number of people at our training seminars feel like prisoners of the human resource department, a management trainer at a multinational bank tells me. They just don't want to be here, and their resistance is infectious. Willingness is crucial, but many organizations pay no attention to whether the people they send for training really want to learn or change. The director of executive development at a Fortune 100 company remarked to me that trainees fall into three groups: the eager beavers, who are ready to change; the vacationers, who are happy to get out of work for a day or two; and the prisoners, who were told by their manager they had to come. One rule of thumb is that only about 20% of a group are ready to put in the work to change at any given point, though the vast majority of development programs are designed as though 100% are. There is no reason to let that low percentage stand. Interest, motivation, and readiness to change, the prerequisites for attending and benefiting from training, can be assessed. If people aren't really ready to change, then that fact itself can become a first focus for them. See Appendix 5 for details. Anything else will be a waste of time. If people are not ready to take action, forcing them will lead to disaster. The sham of going through the motions only to satisfy others causes resentment rather than enthusiasm. To avoid such a waste of time and money, the first step is to help people assess their own readiness. There are four levels of readiness: obliviousness, or outright resistance; contemplating a change at some vague point in the future; ripeness to formulate a plan; and readiness to take action. At American Express Financial Advisors, before a team comes for its training in emotional competence, one of the training staff meets with the team leader, who in turn discusses the program in team meetings to gauge how people feel about going through it. In addition, before they come to the first session, we try to talk to each person about any concerns they might have, Kate Cannon says. Those not ready may benefit from exploring their own values and vision for themselves to see if they want to change at all. Which brings us to the next step. Motivate. The feeling, "I can do it," is the motor that drives change, Robert Kaplan says, and in the jobs program, this is visibly true. When it comes to job seeking, if you don't make the call and keep the appointment, you won't get the job. And to get people to make the effort, you have to raise their expectation of success, pump them up. That applies in general. People learn to the degree they are motivated. Motivation influences the entire learning process, from whether or not someone signs up to whether they actually apply what they've learned in their jobs. And we are most moved to pursue change that fits with our values and hopes. As Weatherhead's Boyatzis puts it, people have to be grabbed by their values, their goals, their dreams of what's possible for them. If you focus at the outset on people's values and visions, on what they want to do with their life, then they see themselves as using the training opportunity for their own development, not just the company's. Windows of opportunity for development, moments when we are most motivated to upgrade our capabilities, come at predictable points in a career. Added responsibility, like a promotion, can make a weakness in emotional intelligence glaringly apparent. Life crises, like trouble at home, career doubts, or a midlife crisis about direction, can offer a fruitful motivation to change. Job troubles, like interpersonal difficulties, disappointment with an assignment, or feeling unchallenged, can motivate efforts to boost competencies. For most of us, the simple realization that cultivating a given capacity will help us do better increases our enthusiasm. Because people here realize these competencies matter for their performance, motivation for training is usually high, Kate Cannon at American Express tells me. When people understand that training can increase their competitiveness in the job market or within the organization, that is, when they see it as an opportunity, their motivation increases. And the more motivated people are to learn, the greater the effectiveness of the training for them. Make change self-directed. The assembly line approach, where everyone in a particular job or role at a company gets sent through an identical program, may work when the content is purely cognitive. But when it comes to emotional competencies, this one-size-fits-all approach represents the old Taylorist efficiency thinking at its worst. Particularly in this domain of education, tailoring, not tailoring, maximizes learning. We change most effectively when we have a plan for learning that fits our lives, interests, resources, and goals. At American Express, everyone designs their own action plan. One financial planner working to boost initiative had a personal goal of making 20 cold calls a week. His plan included writing out the scenario of a successful call and rehearsing it before he dialed each number. That method and focus worked very well for him, says Cannon. But I wouldn't advise all the planners to try it. It might be inappropriate or irrelevant. Plans also need to be fine-tuned to the individual's level of development. We've set it up so that each person can grow and develop from wherever their starting point is, says Cannon. For example, some people simply don't realize that what you say to yourself, your thoughts about what you're doing, affect your results. Others have a more sophisticated understanding. Ideally, trainees should be able to consult a menu of techniques and be encouraged to contribute ideas of their own. One weakness of many prepackaged development seminars is their reliance on a single generic approach. The standard training program, where everyone goes through a cookie-cutter experience, turns out to have the worst return on investment, Charlie Morrow of the consulting firm Linkage tells me. From evaluation research he's conducted at Fortune 500 companies, Morrow concludes, when people have to go, there are many kinds of problems. Some people may already have the skills they're being sent to learn. Others don't need them. Others simply resent having to go, or are just unmotivated. They don't care. Giving people the power to tailor their learning plans to their own needs and aspirations overcomes many of these problems. The guiding principle behind self-directed learning at Weatherhead, says Richard Boyatzis, is you place control of the change process in the hands of the students. After all, they are in control anyway. This approach merely avoids the delusion of faculty control. Focus on clear, manageable goals. He had moved to Ohio from the East Coast to participate in the Weatherhead MBA program, and he needed a part-time job. But he lacked self-confidence, particularly in approaching people he didn't know. At Weatherhead, he was shown how to break his larger goal, developing this kind of self-confidence into smaller, realistic action steps. The first, updating his resume, was easy. But the next steps were more challenging. So he first made these promises to himself. I will call the chairman of the university finance department by next month and request a meeting to discuss any available opportunities there. If not, I'll ask about other people to approach. He planned to do the same with his mentor, a local executive. On top of that, he committed himself to searching the local want ads and calling to apply for promising jobs. And he resolved, I will be confident and assertive in these conversations. The concrete payoff of this strategy, he had a part-time job by the beginning of the next term. The task seems mundane enough. Thousands of people go through similar motions daily. But for this Weatherhead student, these methodical steps were part of a larger plan. They put him in situations that challenged him to practice self-confidence, and each completed step increased his confidence to undertake the next. While a grand goal beckons, the practical focus needs to stay on the immediate, manageable steps, and the operative word is manageable. Those who attempt changes in whopping doses set themselves up for failure. Breaking goals into smaller steps offers easier challenges and successes. Because we are buoyed by frequent small successes, we stay motivated and engaged, propelled by a growing sense of self-efficacy. And the more ambitious the goal, the greater the resulting change. A Japanese strategy takes these two principles into account. In Kaizen, or continuous improvement, people start with goals that are only moderately difficult, and then gradually raise the challenge as the process continues. Making a change in such manageable steps lets us feel we are making at least a bit of progress toward our goal, and so keeps our spirits and hope for success high. Without clear goals, it is easy to wander off course. In the American Express program, seasoned psychologists work with each person to help them create clear personal goals for change. One common goal, for example, is to learn to handle distressing feelings better. But that goal is too global and fuzzy to be useful. People start by realizing they need to take better care of themselves emotionally, Kate Cannon tells me. But when they explore the trouble they have managing their feelings, they realize that it's due to being too stressed, and that often leads them to focus on specific, helpful steps, like better time management. But better time management is itself a fuzzy goal. It needs to be broken down into specifics. For example, spending 20 minutes a day meeting with subordinates to delegate responsibilities, eliminating time wasted watching junk TV, and setting aside 3 hours each week for relaxation. Goal setting should also include the specific steps it will take to get there. For example, if the goal is to become more optimistic, taking setbacks and rejections in stride, an extremely useful competence for someone in sales, the analysis can be fine-grained. You might start by noting your hot buttons, the events that trigger the unhelpful habit, and precisely what you think, feel, and do, says Kate Cannon. You might identify pessimistic self-talk, like, I can't do this. This proves I'm not good at this. Or a pattern. First you get angry, then you withdraw, then you act up. You diagram the pattern or habit, familiarize yourself with what it is you do that you're trying to change, and with the better way to think and act at those times. And each time you encounter one of those hot-button moments, you try to break the old pattern. The closer to the beginning you break it, the better. In a sense, setting a goal defines what amounts to a possible self, a vision of what we will be like after we have changed. Just imagining this potential self has a certain power. Seeing ourselves as able to master the hoped-for change raises our motivation to take the steps to get there. Prevent relapse. Cultivating a new skill is gradual, with stops and starts. The old ways will reassert themselves from time to time. This is particularly true at the beginning, when the new habit feels strange and unfamiliar, and the old habit still feels natural. Training can disintegrate, at least temporarily, in the face of stiff challenges. Such temporary lapses are only to be expected, and that fact can be used to advantage in relapse prevention. The key to using slips constructively is to realize that a step backward is not the same as a total relapse. People need to be warned at the outset of training that they are likely to experience bad days when they revert to their old habits. Showing them how to learn valuable lessons from these slips provides a vaccination of sorts against despair or demoralization at such moments. Otherwise, we might interpret the lapse with pessimism, as a total failure that means we are forever flawed and cannot change. Relapse prevention training prepares them to react like optimists, using slips in an intelligent way to gather critical information about their vulnerabilities and habits. Take a manager who, under time pressure, slides back into dictatorial habits of leadership. He might learn that under pressure, his own anxiety makes him susceptible to falling back on an autocratic style. Once the manager learns to recognize his trigger situations, he can prepare himself to act differently by rehearsing what to do. For example, asking for help instead of barking orders. This will up the odds that he will choose a better response, even under high stress. Of course, developing such an early warning system requires self-awareness and the ability to monitor the incident, or more likely, to do a post-mortem afterward. Tracking the exact events that triggered the relapse and the thoughts and feelings that went along with it gives us added awareness of the moments in which we need to be particularly watchful and consciously recruit our new emotional competence. Seeing the consequences of the lapse, a missed business opportunity, ruffled feelings in a colleague or customer, can also fuel our motivation to pursue change with more vigor. Give performance feedback. A golf pro was prone to unpredictable rages that were ruining both his marriage and his career. While going through a program to reduce the intensity and frequency of his outbursts, he kept a score of sorts, tracking each time he got angry, how long it lasted, and how intensely he felt it. Several months into the program, he blew up as intensely as ever, his rage completely out of control. The episode left him demoralized, despairing that all his efforts to change had led nowhere. But he was re-inspired when he looked at his record. He realized that his rages had decreased markedly, from several times a week to just this one episode in the past 2 months. Feedback lies at the heart of change. Knowing how we are doing keeps us on track. In its most basic form, feedback means that someone notices whether or how well the new competence is being used and lets us know. When we are doing well, there can be a feed-forward effect, where positive feedback buttresses our self-confidence to try out the emotional competence we are working to improve. This heightened self-confidence helps us do even better. When feedback is given poorly, too harshly, or not at all, it can demoralize and demotivate, as we saw in Chapter 8. The best results come when those giving feedback know how to do so productively and are encouraged or rewarded for doing so, and are open to feedback themselves on the quality of their feedback. At American Express Financial Advisors, much of the feedback for emotional competence is woven into the fabric of work. "We pay as much attention to how you do your work as to how well you achieve goals," says Kate Cannon. "There are regular meetings with your direct supervisor. It's a relationship business, not just with our clients, but among ourselves. So people routinely get feedback about their emotional competence, even though it's probably called something else, like teamwork or communication." Encourage practice. An international hotel chain was getting poor ratings from customers on the quality of staff hospitality. So they gave all employees who come into face-to-face contact with customers training designed to bolster their emotional intelligence. The training allowed them to practice being more aware of their feelings and show them how to use that awareness to short-circuit their own amygdala hijacks. It also taught them how to tune into the feelings of the hotel guests and influence their moods positively. But the director of training and development complained that there was no benefit, that things even seemed to get a little worse. How long did the training program last? Just one day. Therein lies the problem. Emotional competence cannot be improved overnight because the emotional brain changes its habits over weeks and months, not hours and days. The old paradigm for development tacitly assumes change occurs dramatically and immediately. Send people through a two-day seminar, and voila, they are transformed. As a result of this misguided assumption, people are sent through brief trainings that have little lasting effect, and then may end up blaming themselves or being blamed by supervisors for some lack of will or determination when the promised improvements fail to materialize. A single seminar or workshop is a beginning, but it is not sufficient in itself. People learn a new skill more effectively if they have repeated chances to practice it over an extended period of time than if they had the same amount of practice lumped into a single, intensive session. Yet this simple rule of thumb is ignored time and again in training. Another mistake is to spend too much time merely talking about the competence, with not enough time devoted to actually practicing it in a controlled situation. In a study of training programs for managers and salespeople, Lyle Spencer Jr. and Charlie Morrow analyzed how training time was divided between learning information about the competence and actual practice. Practice sessions had double the impact on job performance as the presentation of concepts alone. And the return on investment for practice during training was 7 times greater than for the didactic sessions. If you use simulations to teach a competence, like giving feedback, instead of just outlining the 5 principles of effective feedback without any opportunity for practice, the impact of training is far stronger, Spencer notes. Reaching the point where a new habit replaces the old takes extensive practice. As one manager in a government agency put it, people here get sent to a training, then go right back to work with no chance to try it out. So they revert to their old ways. The training never has a chance to transfer back to the job. But overlearning, when people practice a new habit far beyond the point when they can do it well, greatly reduces the likelihood they will revert to the old habit under pressure. Clinical studies of behavior change find that the longer people work at changing, the more durable the change will be. Weeks are better than days. Months are better than weeks. For complex habits, like emotional competence, the practice period for maximal effect may be 3 to 6 months, or longer. For more on practice issues, see Appendix 5. One rule of thumb for improving emotional competence. Capabilities that are being improved on or added to a person's repertoire, like becoming a better listener, can be developed in less time than is needed for remedial learning. Long-established habits, like having a short temper or being perfectionist, are deeply ingrained. In such cases, we need to work both at unlearning the old, automatic habit and at replacing it with the new, improved one. Exactly how long it will take a given person to master an emotional competence depends on a variety of factors. The more complex the competence, the longer mastery takes. Time management, which draws on just a few competencies. Self-control, which is necessary to resist the temptation of time-wasting activities. And achievement drive, which spurs a desire to improve by becoming more efficient, are two essentials for time management. Can be mastered more quickly than, say, leadership, a higher order competence that builds on more than half a dozen other competencies. An effective program will encourage practice on our own time as well. Though we may have work reasons for cultivating a competence like listening, most are relevant in our private lives too. Consider this provocative set of figures. Students in a 2-year full-time MBA program typically spend 2,500 hours in classes and doing assignments. But, assuming they average 7 hours of sleep a night, they are awake about 10,500 hours during those 2 years. The question is, what are they learning during the other 8,000 hours? That question was posed by Richard Boyatzis and the other designers of the Weatherhead course. It led to the proposition that self-directed learning can and should go on whenever and wherever the opportunity arises. Likewise, we don't spend all our waking hours at work, though it may seem we do. Especially when it comes to emotional competence, all of life can be the arena for change. Life itself is the best classroom. That attitude promotes positive spillover, where the skills honed for work pay off elsewhere in life. A supervisor, for instance, learns to listen more effectively to employees and brings it back home in talking with her kids. This positive spillover is seen as an explicit benefit at some companies, such as 3M, where a program designed to lower health costs purposely aims to bolster resiliency competencies for employees both at work and at home. Arrange support. A vice president at one of America's largest food companies had both a bachelor's degree in engineering and an MBA, as well as an IQ somewhere above 125. The president of the company would have liked to promote him. But this vice president had hit a ceiling. He wouldn't get the promotion unless he changed his style. Unsociable and introverted, he was more comfortable sending email or memos than dealing with colleagues face-to-face. In meetings, he was often belligerent, combative, and dictatorial. He would not get promoted unless he stopped doing this, recalled the executive coach brought in to help the otherwise promising vice president. The coach went to work one-on-one with the VP. I helped him to recognize his trigger points, so he can avoid situations where he's more likely to lose it. I taught him how to use self-talk, like athletes do, to prepare for situations where he's prone to get angry. He'll remind himself going in, I'm not going to let this happen to me. I'm not going to lose my temper. And I showed him a technique to short-circuit anger when he feels it building in his body. Tighten all the muscles in his body, then let go all at once. It's a quick muscle relaxation method. The coaching sessions continued for months, until the VP was finally able to manage his anger. Such one-on-one lessons in the essentials of emotional competence are increasingly common in American business, particularly for highly valued employees. Coaching is one of many forms that sustained support can take. Mentors can serve much the same purpose. While the standard view of mentoring is that it's a way to foster career development, mentoring can also serve as a coaching form for boosting emotional competence. As Kathy Cram, director of the executive MBA program at the Boston University School of Management, found in her landmark study of mentors, people can get two kinds of benefits from mentors: help with their careers, such as protection, visibility, and sponsorship, and counseling and coaching. Much learning occurs in the natural course of relationships at work, whether it is deemed coaching or not. As Judith Jordan, a Harvard psychologist, points out, every relationship is an opportunity for both individuals to practice their personal competencies and so grow and improve together. Such reciprocal learning can come naturally in peer relationships, where people can spontaneously alternate between the roles of mentor and learner, depending on their strengths and limits. Some companies, like Bell Atlantic, have experimented with mentoring circles, Kathy Cram tells me. They tried bringing together groups of mid-level women executives and attaching them to a more senior executive to talk over common problems at work. They would tell each other about their experiences, rehash how they could have been handled, and so widen their own repertoire of how to deal with those same situations. The net effect was to build up their social and emotional competence. For those who lack a formal mentor, one strategy is to find a temporary coach, someone adept at a specific skill or competence who will consult for a limited time. This arrangement differs from full-fledged mentoring by virtue of its temporary, task-oriented nature. As Cram has found, any relationship with someone who has greater experience or competence can be an opportunity for learning. And people who develop multiple relationships with a range of coworkers with varying areas of competence stand to improve the most. As part of the American Express Financial Advisors Emotional Competence Training, participants often choose a learning partner, someone who teams with them for continued encouragement over several months, once back on the job. People agree to offer mutual support, to meet regularly for lunch, or to call routinely, says Kate Cannon. They can discuss whatever habit they're trying to change, like worrying too much about things, being more assertive. They update each other, give advice, cheerlead. Such buddy systems increase the transfer of learned emotional intelligence skills to the job. And coaching can be very helpful on the spot. If your partner knows that a particular person pushes your hot buttons, he might help you by giving you a reminder signal to ready yourself just before you go into the encounter, says Cannon. Such on-the-spot support happens more readily when, as in the case at American Express, an entire work group goes through the training together. Weatherhead students are grouped in teams of 10 to 12, each with a facilitator and a corporate executive who serves as advisor. In addition, each student gets a mentor, who is a mid-level manager or advanced professional. The combination of peer group, advisors, and mentor at Weatherhead offers students a variety of people to turn to for support as they strengthen their target competencies. Provide models. In learning a new behavior, having access to someone who exemplifies the competence at its best is immensely helpful. We learn by watching others. If someone can demonstrate a competence, they create a living classroom for us. For that reason, those who teach emotional competence should embody it. Here the medium is the message. Trainers who merely talk about these competencies, but act in ways that make it clear they don't possess them, undermine the message. When it comes to teaching someone how to use a computer program, the trainer's warmth is of relatively little importance. But it's crucial when it comes to helping someone be more expressive and empathic in their dealings with clients, or to control their temper in management meetings. In the jobs program, it was clear we needed trainers who embody social and emotional competence, Robert Kaplan told me. That was the basic principle that guided our selection of trainers, as well as their own training.